It's Mother's Day weekend, and have you been nice to your mom? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy, and along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you, Barry. Here we are in our respective studios, thinking about things that are to come, looking at the things that are happening. And as usual, we are doing our best to analyze them from a biblical perspective. Some people say, well, you're not doing biblical perspective, you're doing politics. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. We are doing politics from a biblical perspective. It's not the only thing we do, but that's what we do most.
Well, I would like to ask a query of those individuals who would say that and say, are you making the assertion that the Bible is devoid of political content, that there was nothing political that was happening in the scriptural accounts? I wonder if there's anybody out there who really actually holds to that particular viewpoint, Chuck, because I know from my reading of scripture, it is full of political content. And I'm not extrapolating it to say it's full of political content. It is full of political content. You have military actions and directions. You have various entities and nations that go to war against each other, that send spies against each other. You have trade negotiations that are within the scriptures. You have people using the laws of the land in order to defend and uphold their belief system. And they also are saying that there's a higher law and a higher belief system. That's a political claim. These are all within the realm and the bounds of a even a cursory reading of the scriptures, that the scripture does not shy away from, nor does it say it's evil and dirty. There's nothing in there that specifically points out anything that's evil and dirty. As a matter of fact, one of our favorite sections of scripture that we've talked about on this program, religiously, is Romans 13.
Yes.
And where basically it says that God sets up the civil authorities and directs them in the way they should go, because they're supposed to reward good and punish evil. And of course, he doesn't leave it to those authorities to determine what is good and evil, because he's given it to us in his word. He said so, do what's good, do what's right. And this is good and this is evil. That's why we had 10 commandments, not the 10,000 or half a million pages of regulations at the federal, state, and local levels to basically say that we're smarter than God. But guess what actually starts happening? So to say that talking about politics is not honoring God, is not following the biblical model, or is not in line with a Christian worldview, I believe is a claim that can't be backed up with anything but emotion rather than the clear, exposited teaching of Scripture.
Well, I have gotten in trouble for saying this, and I'm not good, because I'm not wrong on this.
You've gotten in trouble for saying good?
Yes, no, what you said. But
wait a minute, there's that other political thing. Woe unto those who call evil good and good evil.
Exactly.
That's a political statement.
I can remember asking people, I'm going to go back to what I was thinking about, but I remember asking people in Romans 13, I've done a presentation where I said, okay, just do word replacement. And replace the ruler or magistrate, minister, whatever the translation you're using says, and replace it with Stalin or Hitler or name your mass murdering dictator. And tell me that's exactly what God meant. God did mean it. Obviously, God appointed the leader, and he meant for that thing to happen. But why did he mean it to happen? He meant it to happen as a judgment. And you can name the reasons why God was bringing judgment upon these, and I know we'll get in trouble for that. Again, go back and read Romans 13 and replace the word talking about the leader with your favorite, and see what I mean. Okay, now, what have I gotten in trouble for? Well, the Easter season has recently been passed, just passed. And one of the things I've always said is that Jesus was killed by a four-way conspiracy. Now, I've had pastors come down, Jesus gave up his life willingly. And I said, yes, but what was the worldly method by which he was brought to the point where he would be executed? And the answer is, there's a four-way conspiracy. And it was political in nature. If you think about it, the four members of the conspiracy, the Romans, the Herodians, the Zealots, and the Sanhedrin.
Yes,
they all worked together to make sure that what happened happened. They all had completely different reasons. They all had completely different methods, and they all worked together to get it done. Why did the Romans? The Romans basically saw that they had someone who was essentially a bone of contention and a flashpoint, and they removed him. Okay?
Yes. Yes, that was their whole goal, was to basically quell what they considered to be a potential uprising in the making.
The Herodians were involved because essentially Herod was embarrassed by Christ. He had also been embarrassed by John the Baptist, and he simply wanted him gone. And you can see that in some of the gospel accounts when Herod and Pontius Pilate became friends on the day, because Pilate sent him to Herod for judgment, and Herod sent him back. And suddenly Herod and Pilate were buddies, and they had not liked each other before that. So that bone of contention. Now, why the Zealots? What did the Zealots want? The Zealots wanted a martyr.
Well, of course they did.
To start a revolt, so they could start their revolt against the Roman, foreign rule.
Yeah, absolutely.
And why the Sanhedrin? Well, it's obvious. They knew exactly who Christ was, and they couldn't deal with it and didn't want to. Therefore, they wanted him dead, thinking that that would end, for forgetting who they worshipped as God, and which was part of the problem in the first place. So was there a four-way conspiracy? Of course there was. Did Jesus go to the grave willingly? Yes. Who was behind it all? God was. God allowed the delusion to come over the eyes of those four different groups.
Mm-hmm. True.
And why? Because it had to happen. So there you go. Four-way conspiracy. Was it political? Oh, you bet it was. It was all about power.
Incredibly political.
Power and position. So, and who ended up being king? King Jesus.
Well, absolutely.
So, you know, I'm unimpressed when people tell me that, I'm also unimpressed when people tell me that Satan is in control on the earth. Nope. That's the whole point. Satan was thrown out. He was crushed the minute that Christ passed from life to death. Satan was done. Why do you think that all these bad things happen? Earthquakes, people, my wife and I were listening to a gospel account, and where the one where it talks about some dead when Jesus was passed, that some dead bodies revived and walked around. She goes, I never heard this before. I go, huh, come on. We've read through the scriptures before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I said, some people let that kind of stuff pass because it's too much for them to deal with.
Well, you know, we had our Easter message, okay, at church. I mean, it's hilarious that you're saying this because, gosh, I didn't realize we went to the same church 200 miles apart from each other. Because, you know, we had the way our little Presbyterian church works is our regular pulpit supply for the last 25 years is a ruling elder who is licensed to preach and is, you know, basically pulpit supply for us. Because we're not big enough to afford to be able to pay a pastor,
right,
you know, supply insurance and, you know, retirement fund and all that other fun stuff. We're just a little teeny country church. So what we do is once a month, because, you know, in our denomination, I think similarly to yours, the ruling elders cannot serve communion or officiate communion.
Right.
So you have to have a teaching elder.
You have to have a TE to manage
the distribution and the serving of the elements. That's right. So we invite a retired pastor in our presbytery to come, and, you know, he and his wife drive 3 hours one way to come down once a month for us, and they love being with us, and, you know, it's been great. But before he was getting ready to give the message on Resurrection Sunday, Our, I call him pastor. I mean, you know, it's kind of joking, like I call you doctor. He got up and he basically went right to that passage. Matthew said, you know, here's the thing I've never heard commentators deal with. And he, it was that whole idea of the graves opening up and people being, you know, opening their, he goes, I wonder what people thought when they opened their doors and there's Uncle Ned, but Uncle Ned's been dead for a year and a half.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, who we were listening to was R.C. Sproul, who was dealing with that passage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right around the time of the Easter, Resurrection Day and all that. And he was dealing with that passage, and he says, this one is just, you know, how can anybody not be convinced of who Christ was when, you know, like you said, Uncle Ebor shows up at the, aren't you dead? It's kind of the same thing when Peter shows up in Acts. At the door, they're sitting there praying for him and you know, lamenting about what they're going to do. And Peter comes to the door, and they say, well, it's not Peter. It's got to be his spirit, so he's dead.
Yeah.
No. the reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. It's me. So I know what happens when I'm confronted with something that I know to be supernatural. Your first inclination is to dismiss it. You know?
Oh, sure.
It's natural. Why? Because we're surrounded by the natural world, and we're surrounded by God's order. Well, when something that's out of God's order, normal order, happens, we're sort of like, nah, uh-uh. It's an illusion, or you'd think that happened, but it didn't happen. It's easy to see why skeptics, there's a video on YouTube put out by some atheists, and it basically said 17 things in the Bible that just didn't happen.
Okay.
And, okay, what evidence, I know you can't prove a negative, but the fact is, you're saying they didn't happen because they're outside the norm. And it, you know, it's going to be a lot of stuff, with people raising from the dead and mm-hmm. All kinds of stuff. Pardon me. And you cannot deal with someone who completely rejects the idea of the spiritual realm, the non-physical. Now, the fact is that, you know, God knows this. But he also knows that there are people who can be brought around to realizing, yeah, okay, that was an extra... That was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
They're out there. People who should be dead, who aren't, for some reason. I was in an automobile accident in 1981. I was going 60 miles an hour without not wearing a seatbelt in a 1977 Chevy Monte Carlo.
Thankfully, you were in a car made of steel.
Well, not only that, I was made in a car that had a front end that you required a periscope to see past the front. That car was way long in the front. And in any case, what happened was, as I'm traveling along M66 in Michigan, driving 60 miles an hour, a drunk guy suddenly... just as he gets right where I am, comes left to center and hits me. And he was going it faster than me because he was driving a car lighter than mine. And he drove me backwards about 50 feet. So I came to a complete stop from 60 and went backwards into a ditch. My brother and I were together, neither one of us wearing a seatbelt. Nobody in the three, none of the three people involved in the accident was wearing a seatbelt. My brother lost his four front teeth. And he bashed his head on the windshield. He recovered. I mean, he still deals with the four front teeth gone. I mean, he has a bridge and all that stuff. But I have a number of physical injuries that plague me to this day. Nonetheless, I'm alive. And the guy who hit us, as far as I know, is alive. He and I are not friends. Yeah. And he was skunk drunk. We thought he was dead. I was unable to walk. And in fact, I was unable to get up off the ground. I sent my brother over to check on the guy. And he said, the steering wheel is in his chest. And he goes, I can't see him breathe. I think he's dead. Well, he wasn't dead. And actually, he got out of the hospital before I did.
Wow.
So, how do you survive? Let's just say that somewhere the impact was somewhere between 125 and 130 miles an hour. Because two cars going opposite directions.
Exactly. Opposite directions.
It's, both at 60 plus it was miles as an hour, if yeah. I'd hit a wall going 100 and somewhere between 120 and 130 miles an hour. My car, the insurance adjuster showed me a picture of my car after I got home from the hospital, which took 3 weeks. And I was nauseated.
Yep.
The whole car was, my whole side of the car was moved back about 3 feet. In other words, the driver's side door wouldn't close because it was back, it would have been closing into the back seat. So I know that miracles exist because I was in one. Why did God choose to protect me? I don't know. Why did God choose to protect my brother and this other fella that were in the car? I don't know. He had his purpose. All three of us should be dead. All three of us aren't dead. And again, I'm not telling you, life's all hunky-dory and it's all rainbows and sunshine. I have pain every day from injuries. But you know what I don't have? I don't have my mother lamenting because I've been dead these 38 years.
Right, exactly.
Did that make me believe? No, I was already a believer. I had no trouble reconciling the fact that God had, for whatever reason, protected us. He didn't protect us. He protected us from death. He did not protect us from injury. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, if God's going to protect you, you're going to come out completely intact. I don't think so. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of the book of Genesis when, Jacob or Isaac? Wrestled with the man all night. And at the end, the man touched his hip and made him lame.
Yep, exactly.
Why? As a reminder.
Yes.
So, do I have reminders? Yeah, I do have lots of reminders. Okay, going back to that, there are people who cannot accept the miraculous and reject it. Say there is no spiritual realm and all that stuff. And the obvious argument to that is, Greg Bonson was good at this. He basically said, okay, where do the laws of logic and mathematics and all these abstract concepts, where do they exist? They don't, it's not, the laws of mathematics and all these things and logic and things do not exist because we agreed on them. They exist.
Right, yeah.
The attempt has been made by
transcendent laws.
Yes, the attempt has been made, it's called the argument from transcendency. I think it's a strong argument. Somebody said that the atheists now have a refutation to it. I don't think so. You cannot refute that there is a realm in which things exist that are abstract. Now, the beauty of where God is in the spiritual realm, can he transcend? Transform into this realm, into the physical? Well, the answer is obviously yes, because he did.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's where people get messed up. That's where people, atheists, agnostics, you can't prove that. And I'm like, you're asking me to prove something from an abstract. Well, now, we can prove the laws of logic. We can prove the laws of mathematics. We can also prove, actually, that God exists, but you can't do it in a physical fashion. We prove mathematical law and logical law in the same thing by applying it. And when something doesn't make sense, when we can't make things work, then we know that we're off the path. We're off the reservation, if you will. The same thing happens with God. Again, I know that God exists. I have experienced, and I agree, again, it's a personal experience, and therefore it's subject to my personal prejudices and that kind of thing. Yeah, it is.
Yes,
and,
it is.
And when someone comes to you and says, well, I can prove that one and one does not equal two, you and I both know that's a violation of the laws of mathematics. Right? Because this guy went into this. I had a mathematician do this to me. I said, I can prove to you. And I said, I've seen that proof. And I said, what you do is you go into a statistical argument in which you basically enter in some uncertainty. And he said, that's exactly right. I said, I'm not kidding you that I can work that proof. let's not go too far. He says, I can work it. And I said, yeah. But I looked over at him and I held up two fingers and I go, how many fingers am I holding up? And he laughed and he said, yeah, that's the problem with that, with that argument.
2.06753124.
Right, yeah.
It's like, no, just two.
No, he laughed. He acknowledged. He says, yeah, the concrete sort of wipes out the theoretical at that point.
Yes,
exactly. And that's my point. And that's actually part of the proof that God exists, because he doesn't fool around with the universe. If the universe really were truly a random place, And just these random things happen, like poof, one day the right combination of things happened and life just appeared on Earth. It would have been a very crude form of life, but it would have been life. And I'm like, okay, everybody, if you talk to an honest biologist, he'll tell you that's a fairy story.
Yeah.
It's a fairy story. Because I have a degree in biochemistry. I can tell you that there are hundreds and thousands of processes that have to happen for a cell to be alive. And these things just don't come together. Everybody thinks, oh, it's a simple life form. There is no such thing. That's the problem. There's an argument, and Dr. Michael Behe wrote a book. It's a great book. I would suggest going out and finding a copy. I just bought a copy used at a bookstore, a hardback. It's called Darwin's Black Box.
Yes.
And Behe has written a number of things, but Darwin's Black Box is a great book because it explains that there is such a thing as irreducible complexity.
That's right.
What that means is that, and the explanation he gives is a mousetrap. What part can you remove from a mousetrap and have it continue to function as a mousetrap? I'm talking about one of these little simple wood board ones you can go walk in the hardware store and buy. It's got a spring on it. What part can you take off and have the thing still function as a mousetrap? And the answer is none. There
none.
Is,
there, that's right.
They're simple and eloquent. I'm sorry, elegant.
That's all right. That's why we're here.
they do the job they're designed to do with a minimum number of parts. So what's the minimum number of parts? Well, someone has estimated that the minimum number of enzymes is 100. And that includes the fact that you have to have a reproductive system intact and operating. Otherwise, you can have spontaneously generated life all you want. You're not going to have any more. Because the thing will not be able to reproduce itself. Reproduction is a very complex function, and I will tell you that it's a complex function of design. The reason that critters all use DNA is the same reason that all vehicles have round wheels. It works. You can encrypt data in it, and you can have systems to unencrypt that data and build things. It's far more complex than a wheel.
Yes, absolutely.
That is a proof of God. The fact that the universe exists is a proof of God. When I hear stories told by atheists, well, we now know that the universe could have created itself from nothing. Okay, where'd that come from? Well, it came from Stephen
Hawking. That's a whole lot of nothing.
Yes.
If you think about the size and the complexity and the numerous bodies that are spread throughout this universe.
One of the reasons that story works is because human beings have no concept of nothing.
Yeah, that's it.
We don't. I'm not talking about empty space. There is no space.
Great. Yeah, space doesn't exist either.
No. Well, somebody says, well, then where does God exist? And I go, you don't understand the spiritual realm. It requires no dimensionality. That's the bottom line. Well, I this mathematician friend was curious because he looked at it from a scientific standpoint. He goes, well, God lives out somewhere beyond our, you know, he says, we're in three. He's probably in 11 or 20. He gave 11 or 27, I think, is what he told me. Because that's where the math all folds up. And I'm like, well, maybe. Or maybe he lives in none. But the bottom line is, people can believe these stories of things creating themselves from nothing because they have don't have a firm concept of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They also don't have a really firm grasp of infinity. I know I don't. Everything human beings touch, feel, taste, smell, experience has a beginning and an end. It doesn't. We can't think in terms of when we start hearing about billions of light years, your brain kind of shuts down, right? But billions of light
years. It can, yes.
Billions of light years still isn't infinite. It's just really big.
Well, it's like, I'm going to think on infinity for a little bit. I'll let you know when I'm done.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll take an infinite amount of time to actually think through that.
Never happened.
And, you know, that's why we always laugh about, you know, some mathematical things that some number equals infinity. It's like, well, okay, that's undefined. There is, in any case, we go back, and atheists can make these points because people don't think through it. Now, the idea that the universe created itself came from Stephen Hawking, who basically said, because there is a law of gravity. Now, get this. Because there is a law of gravity, then the universe could have created itself. Now, it's an oversimplification. It's a mathematical hocus-pocus. And by the way, I would tell you, it's mathematical hocus-pocus based on a transcendent law. Where did the transcendent law come from? Gosh, that's a great question. How can there be a transcendent law when there's nothing?
Well, that's just a little bugaboo.
We
can ignore that. Walk away. Just ignore that over there. Walk away.
It exists in that spiritual realm. And the same thing can be said for all those physical laws. Now, Hawking, you know, went to his grave thinking he'd solved that problem. For years, he'd been trying to solve the problem of how people would ask him about God, and he's like, I haven't solved that problem yet. There was a mathematician named Laplace who brought some things to Napoleon, who was not dumb, and showed him these equations, and he says, you have made no allowance for the Creator. Napoleon said to Laplace, and Laplace says, sire, I have no need for that hypothesis. Okay, where did the laws of mathematics come from? Let me ask you a question. From where does gravity emanate? Where does it seem? Where is its center?
It's the center of the Earth. Now, come on.
Yeah, well, you're right insofar as that is the center of the mass.
The center of the mass, that's right.
You have to have mass to have gravity. What isn't there in a no matter, no energy, no space scenario?
Well, obviously no gravity either.
There's no mass. No mass means no gravity.
Yeah.
You know, even a little dust particles that are floating around have some mass, and so therefore some gravity. Mm-hmm. Now, there are other parts of the creation, you know, self-creation stories that atheists love to tout, and they're being taught in schools and that kind of thing. They're impossible. I don't want to go into that. But the fact is that God does exist, and we believe that an absolute proof essentially is creation. Because essentially it's the impossibility of the contrary, as Bonson liked to say. the impossibility of the contrary is that nothing came from something. And R.C. Sproul has a little talk, I guess. He gets all excited, as he usually does. And he says he'd heard on the news a scientist say 15.5 billion years ago, the universe exploded into being from nothing. And he gets all excited and he says, what made it explode? And oh, by the way, how can nothing explode? It's nothing.
Now, you're just being mean. Now, stop that.
Well, I am being mean. But these are questions that have to be asked.
That have to be asked. Now, and you asked
them.
Answered.
If you went into your high school classroom and asked your physical science teacher this question, you'd get a pat answer. Well, you know, greater thinkers than I have thought through this, and they've come up with the answers. The problem is that the answers are exceedingly unsatisfactory. Exceedingly. What's the satisfactory answer? That an omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, all-powerful, all-seeing God made it happen.
Mm-hmm.
In the space of 6 days. That's why I'm a 6-day creationist, despite being I'm not ashamed of that. God says He made it in six. He made it in six.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you know, these are type of things that, you know, we're never going to settle with those who want to deny the clear teachings of Scripture, deny the physical evidence that's around them, deny the scientific proofs that continue to verify the scriptural accounts. You're always going to have people who are not satisfied with anything, Chuck. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Well,
and,
yeah.
But our job is to not satisfy all their answers or satisfy all their questions, but to question all of their solutions. Because, hey, you know, if you're following an atheist, then we all came from pond slime. There's nothing special about this place, and we don't go anywhere after we're done, so we might as well just go ahead and get whatever we want for ourselves while we're here, because there's no morality, there's no law, and there's no consequences. I don't know about you, but if you take those three assertions in mind, there's also no things as society, community, or family, because you can't have those with that radical self-interest being ascendant. And so, yeah, I just look at the atheists, the agnostics, the, I don't know, how do they consider themselves? The skeptics. Let's just put it that way, the skeptics.
Oh, well, if you, who was it? Richard Dawkins, who said, we're the brights.
Yeah, well, there's that, too. And I just look at them and say, well, no, you know, if we actually molded our foundations around your framework, there would be no foundation. There is no floor. There are no walls. There is no ceiling. There's no safe house here. It's only through the fact that God is, He is who He says He is. He's sovereign over everything. He has laws that govern the universe, continually govern the universe, and laws that govern our interactions, even though we rebel against Him, that we can have those things such as a society or a community or a family. You know, dwell on that for a little bit. You know, like I said, you know, kind of going back to our opener, this is the weekend that we acknowledge and celebrate, and the vast majority of people do, Mother's Day.
Yeah.
You know, we thank Mom for all the things she's done for us. Well, okay, the first thing she did for us was she was obedient to God's plan for her in bringing forth the next generation, you know? And for many, many of us, that is, you know, she grew up, she got married, she then started having a family. And... you know, if you don't, you could thank Mom for great baking great cakes or for patching up the boo-boos or for whatever, driving you to all of your sports practices. But if you forget forget about thanking mom for bringing you into the world.
Yeah, for being obedient to God. And first of all...
And I don't care how you feel about your mother. I mean, I know a lot of people have dysfunctional families and you know, they have bitterness or regrets or other things. I don't care how you feel about that. The key point is that you wouldn't be here to feel it if she had been selfish. And so that's what, I mean, that's the first thing I have to thank mom for, is not being selfish. You know, because it is a sacrifice, you know, to carry a child for 9 months in utero and then go through labor and then care for a child who's defenseless and has no ability to provide for their own, you know, food, shelter, warmth, etc. on their own for a number of years. That's a sacrifice. And so before you stop to thank mom for her great pasta recipe or for the way her house looks or her flower garden she planted, thank her for not being selfish.
Yeah, and think about your mom. She dealt with you when you were two. I have a granddaughter, and we watch her during the day, and we are approaching 2 years old, and let me tell you that I'd forgotten what a challenge that is.
What a challenge a two-year-old is, that's right.
You know, and that's why we get to be grandparents. And I told my granddaughter the other day, she has this shriek that she does when she's unhappy, and it's a real ear splitter. And I just said, I had to speak harshly to her, and I said, you know what? When grandpa is forced to speak harshly to you, it's bad. So I'm telling you, you're being bad. We're not coddling grandparents, although we do spoil a little bit, you know. But we're not coddling grandparents.
Really?
Yeah, I know. We're not coddlers. We are spoilers a little bit, but because I'm not going to allow that to go on and then have her go home and do that to her mother. Why? Because I respect my daughter for what she does as a mother. And, you know, we need to respect mothers because of the things that they do for us. Fathers as well. But our day isn't until June, and essentially it's not the same. It's not the same. Dad does many important things, and my
Oh yeah, I'm not discounting fathers whatsoever.
Yeah,
but
especially if he's in the home, and
it's like that old adage about, you know, with your breakfast, you know, the chicken is involved and the pig is committed. Well, same thing with raising, you know, bringing in children to the world. The father is involved, the mother is committed.
Yeah, exactly. We have things that we need to do, you know, nurturing wise. We need to be good examples and provide and be the strong one sometimes. And although moms tend to be, pretty steel backboned as well, when they need to be, yeah. And we definitely go out, make sure you do something to show your appreciation to your mom.
And that's the whole thing with Mother's Day, kind of wrapping back around to what you were saying. That's another proof of God.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the fact that we actually have a continuation of generational lines is the fact that God had determined that it was not good for man to be alone.
Yep.
And gave him a helpmeet. And that helpmeet bore children. Because if you see in the scriptures, God wasn't, you know, didn't ever have a plan for Adam to be by himself and all of a sudden, you know, generate children out of the mix.
No, and in fact, how would he have done it?
I don't even want to go there. But the whole, you know, because we've got people now who are basically trying that, Chuck. I mean, you know, with the whole body modification, transgenderism, the I was a girl, now I'm a guy, and now I'm having a baby. It's like, no. Okay, just no. Or as I heard somebody say it the other day, it isn't gender change, it's cosmetic surgery.
Well, okay. Again, from a biochemical perspective,
yes,
you have a genetic makeup. And there are people that are convinced that if they just get enough hormone shots that you'll go from a from one set of genes to another. Nope, you are stuck with your genetic makeup. You know, I'm not going to sit here and arrogantly say there aren't mistakes in gene expression or mistakes in reproduction that create havoc in a very small number of people's bodies. But mm-hmm. for the most part, if you think you're one sex when you're actually another one, you have gender dysphoria issues and you actually need psychological help, not the laws of the land to change to punish people who won't accept the fact that you as a man are not a woman. And you can have all the surgery in the world and it doesn't change the fact that you have a double X or an XY chromosome on number 23, 23rd chromosome. That bottom line. And the more we kid ourselves that somehow gender is fluid and that there are, you know, and it depends on who you talk to, 13 different genders, 27 genders, 52. No, there aren't. There are two. There are two, male and female. And to those who have genetic anomalies, I will say if there's a Y in the mix, you are a male, whether you exhibit the primary characteristics or not. And mm-hmm. It used to be funny when we'd see a guy in women's clothes because you immediately recognized that he was making a joke.
Mm-hmm.
The comedian, Uncle Milty, Milton Berle. Milton Berle made half a career out of dressing up in women's clothes, and everybody knew and everybody laughed because it was a joke. I mean, he was clearly not a female.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the old thing about, you know, he'd say makeup, and they'd come in and poof, and they'd hit him in the face with a pancake thing, and and now you're not allowed to laugh. You're no longer allowed to laugh at that kind of nonsense because it hurts their feelings because they identify as a woman. Well, you know, if I identify as a pastrami sandwich, does that mean I get to coat myself in mustard and put myself in the window for sale? It's absurd. And I have illustrated absurdity by being absurd, but there are some true people who have things implanted in their heads and horns put on their foreheads and their ears bobbed and all kinds of body modification. Why? Because that's how they perceive themselves. There's something wrong with that. God basically has made it clear that we're not to attempt to modify ourselves. Now, you know, I've known people who've gone a little nuts over the whole, tattooing and all that thing, all that stuff and piercings and all that. And I'm like, look, you're in an area where I think you need biblical guidance, but am I going to do something about it? And the answer is no, I'm not. Why? Because it's not my business. Okay. But when it becomes my business is when I can't do certain things and hire certain people and tell them to do certain things because the law protects them. It may be offensive to my customers, but that's too bad. No. Then it becomes my business. And I say, mm-hmm. No, you can't do that. And that's the problem we are into in society today. Barry, We're in the society where we have to, we have to accept anything that anyone gives us, from their sexuality to their appearance. I'm always amazed at people who are covered in tattoos and have piercings all over the place, and they want to be a cashier someplace. Well, you can't do that here. Why not? Because your appearance frightens the customers. Oh, no. You're discriminating against me. Well, the answer is yes, I am. Why? Because of your physical appearance. You can't work here. Somebody else might take you on. I won't. And what happens then? You get sued, and very often you lose. Well, because discrimination mm-hmm. has become a bad word. Well, we discriminate all the time. If my wife cooks me up a nice steak and then offers me a raw one, I discriminate against the raw one. And I'll eat the cooked one. Why? Because I don't like raw steak. I don't mind it a little pink in the center. That's nice. Nice little medium rare. If I'm offered a salad with fresh greens versus greens that have been in the refrigerator for 3 weeks, which one do you think I take? I take the fresh greens. Why? Because brown lettuce does not impress me. And it actually sort of nauseates me. I have discriminated against it. Why? Because it's very likely unhealthy. And the fact is that that is why discrimination is not a bad word. Now, is there certain kinds of discrimination that is bad? Yeah. If you just simply refuse to hire someone because they're a certain color or a certain age or a certain name any number of physical characteristics, then you are using discrimination in a bad sense. I can remember we used to go to a restaurant where one of the waitresses was had obviously been horribly burned in a fire, had lost part of her arm and that, all kinds of stuff. You know what? She was a good waitress. Once you get over the shock, you're sort of like, you ignore it. You ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. I worked with a guy who was a little person. He was a dwarf, as I recall. The midget and a dwarf are two different things. He was a dwarf, as I recall. And you go into his office, and he was an executive, and you had to deal. I think he was a benefits guy. And you walk in there, and his name was Ed. And I can remember Ed would... you didn't even notice it. He was sitting at his desk, and we'd see him out in the hallway. Yeah, you're shocked the first time you see it, and after that, who cares? It's Ed. You know, that's the way you're supposed to handle that kind of stuff. There are some things that you don't have to learn how to handle because it's someone mocking God. And there are certain kinds of markings that people take and modifications they do to their body that basically say to God, you didn't make me right, I'm going to fix it. And that goes along with this gender dysphoria where you have surgeries to make things happen that God did not intend. That's a mocking of God. And that's why it's unacceptable. A piercing, you can say it's a sin of vanity because you like mm-hmm. the way it works. You like the way it looks. Yeah, that's okay. It is a sin of vanity. Yeah. Is it one of those things where are you really mocking God? No, you're saying I'm just going to take what you gave me and make it look better. Okay. Well, that's a matter of opinion. But in truth, there are some of these things like people having their teeth filed off. So they're pointy, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just,
mm-hmm.
it's truly just a mockery of God. And there, my soapbox.
Well, you know, that's fine. You can be on that soapbox. That's perfectly fine. You know, Chuck, I mean, again, it's a situation where, you know, God was not at all ever, he's not ever surprised by the extent to which man, his creation, will go to try to deny him and to set themselves up in his place. The scripture's replete with situations of that sort. And even, you know, when people doubt, I mean, that's the reason why I always look and say, you know, okay, if you are a skeptic, an atheist, an agnostic, whatever, just do me a favor. Go to the book of Job and answer the questions that Job was asked.
Right.
Just answer them. Okay. You know, let's just make it easy. Just go to that book.
It's in the later chapters of Job, yes.
Later chapters of Job, like 36 or something, like 35, 36, somewhere in there. And just answer the questions that God puts to Job, who was a faithful servant of his. And, you know, God was not being mean to Job. He wasn't being evil. He wasn't, you know, condemning him in any way with these questions. He was just helping him to understand that God's oversight, sovereignty, if you will, care and continuing development of all that happens around us isn't something that we are capable of doing. It isn't something that we somehow, if we can just get God to go away, we can take over and have it continue to run. I mean, Chuck, although it is explained scientifically how an acorn grows into an oak, I still have trouble with the, shall we say, imbalance in the ratio of the mass of those two things.
Well, it goes beyond that, Barry. We know how it works. We don't know why it works.
Why it works. Well, and that's the key, is the whys. But that's the whole thing of when people are, you know, screaming and yelling about how, you know, God, you know, God is dead, or God doesn't exist, or I, you know, I hate God, or I don't need God. What they're basically saying is, I am claiming I have answers to all the whys. So go ahead, start putting them out there. Let's hear them. Let's test them. Let's be scientific about it, because you know what, Chuck, you're a scientist. When you have a theory, a hypothesis that's put out there, what's the standard of it being accepted?
Well, you have to provide the way the scientific method works is you form a hypothesis, and then you do experiments to break the hypothesis. In other words, if you can't break it, then it must be correct up to the point that the hypothesis goes. So you have to actually prove your hypothesis by trying to make it not work.
Okay.
That's the bottom line on the scientific method. You ask questions, you form a hypothesis, and then you try to disprove the hypothesis.
Yes. Thank you.
So
you try to disprove it. Now, okay, again, go ahead and give me the whys. And I'll guarantee you that for an atheist and agnostic, there'll be a way to disprove it.
Well, yeah. Now, again, you have to be careful because prove this didn't happen. Well, you can't. Basically, you can't prove a negative.
Well, and that gets us right back around to the argument you said that, you know, they believe that the atheists come out and said that, you know, the Bible's not true. Well, were you there?
Yes. One of the problems you have is, Barry, there are two different kinds of science, and we're gonna run short on time here, and that's fine. But this will get this explanation. There are two different kinds of science. There's observational and experimental science, which, in other words, real science, where you do experiments and you record the results and you calculate, you know, what you apply mathematics to it or some other descriptive methodology, and you have a concrete set of data that you can look at. And then there's historical perspective science, quote unquote, and that's what we have with the things like people who say the dinosaurs were 65 million years ago. Okay, were you there 65 million years ago? Did you count back the years? No. Well, how do you get there? It's all indirect evidence based on assumptions. It's what's called perspective science or historical science. There are major problems with historical science in that if you can prove, and a number of these things have been proven, if you can prove that some of the processes that you make assumptions that take place in a certain amount of time actually take place in a much shorter time frame, then you have disproven the hypothesis of the age of rocks, fossils, all kinds of things. If you can find issues with, for instance, carbon dating. Now, one thing you should know about carbon dating, about the furthest you can go back with carbon dating is 25,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because carbon has a half-life. In other words, a half-life is the amount of time it takes for half the sample to convert to decay. So half. You get about... once you get out to about 99.99% of the sample gone, you can't measure it anymore. And eventually it is all gone. So the furthest back you can go, so essentially, can you determine that there are problems with that? Yeah, well, people have done all kinds of stuff, like taking living organisms and freshly kill them and do carbon-14 on them, and it'll show that they've been dead for 44,000 years. So are there problems? Yes. Are there problems with isotope dating, which gets done with rocks? Yeah, there are. And you know what the problems are? The problems are that you measure the isotopes, you assume the age of the rocks based on the layer, and you say, well, then, it had to start out with this isotope because, we know the half-life and therefore, this originally was this old. And so you're essentially doing circular reasoning. You are using a possibly critically flawed assumption to age other things. That's the problem with non-observational science, perspective science or historical science. Mm-hmm. You really don't know for sure what you're dealing with. And sometimes you're drastically wrong. And I realize I might be barking, you know, we're at the end of this. There's a lot of stuff on YouTube about from creation, Answers in Genesis, Institute for Creation Research, lots of videos. Go out and look. There are some people I would avoid. I wouldn't waste too much time. I know I'm going to make some people mad on this. I wouldn't waste too much time on Kent Hovind. Some of his stuff is questionable at best. But some of the stuff out of Answers in Genesis and the Institute for Creation Research is first rate. Do I necessarily agree with all the conclusions? No. Do I necessarily understand all the stuff that I've seen? No. But I'm open-minded about that. And I much more so than I think my evolutionary colleagues are. Because I've heard and seen them jump through hoops. There was a lecture once given in college when I was there, and it was chaos as the driving force behind evolution. It was essentially a platitude-ridden apologia that basically said you either have to believe this or we're going to ostracize you. What's the bottom line? And I said, okay, well, I can regurgitate this for tests. But I think it's nonsense. I was never an evolutionist. I got into a thing where I thought maybe God uses certain processes. But I still do think that. God does, use certain processes to make changes happen. I mean, all the animals are not exactly the same as they were when they were created. But there were specific kinds, and he did create the species as they were. And there have been changes over time. It's way too late in the game to explain that. Maybe we'll leave that for another day. But that being said, we are out of time. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And I'll let Barry say that wasn't anything like what we'd planned to talk about today.
No, but, you know, sometimes the spirit intervenes.
That's right. But if you want to hear more of this or politics, we'll go back to politics because we started out talking about that. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.